You're listening to the PC Gamer Podcast for November 29th, 2007. This is episode 110. Welcome, one and all, to the PC Gamer Podcast for November 29th. I'd like to welcome with open arms our senior executive editor, Chuck Osborne.
Waka waka.
Chuck, we're so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm so glad. Senior associate editor, Dan Stapleton. Dan, Stapleton.
That just became your new nickname.
Stapes?
Dan Stapes. Stapleton.
Yeah, whatever. I can roll with that.
Former PC Gamer editor-in-chief and former Backspace columnist, Gary Gazwitta. And our ever-faithful podcast producer out in Chicago, Jeremy Pops Williams.
Hey, guys.
Hello, too.
Chuck, I guess I didn't give you a nickname. Oh, and Norm! No, Norm's here, too! Oh, I completely forgot. I'm so sorry. And long-suffering senior associate. What are you, senior executive intern now?
That's true.
Norman Chan.
Hello.
But you know what? It's entirely possible Norm won't be our senior executive intern for long.
What?
Not if he successfully auditions for that very, very popular CW show, Beauty and the Geek. Well,
there are popular CW shows.
So Norm, which one would you be, the Beauty or the Geek?
I haven't decided yet. I guess I could apply as either.
When is it? So what is it? What's
you could be
the
a beautiful geek?
What's involved in the application process?
I have no idea. All I know is I was sent a link to this website that was on the CW website to an application form to apply for the show. It's a reality show called Beauty and the Geek, and it requires that you film a 10-minute video or something. But I didn't want to do that. So instead, there's actually going to be an open casting call this Saturday
where?
In the East Bay in Emeryville.
So you know what? I feel like it's a good thing that we know this ahead of time, because here you have gathered the mind share right here that can help you prepare for your Beauty and the Geek open casting call.
That's right. I mean, it's Emeryville is right by Berkeley, so I imagine the competition's going to be pretty stiff.
It's going to be pretty tough. We're going to find an Asian nerd in Berkeley.
Exactly.
Crazy.
I know. Seriously.
Well, the problem is, okay, so I went to the cast info for the latest season.
I'd like to know.
It looked like there's only room for one Asian.
I also like to know that in the cast, it lists each person's name, and then underneath says herself or himself. Like, just to remind us that they're playing themselves on the show.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, these shows are, you know, somewhat scripted, and all the, yeah, all the, they're all written, right, yes?
Well, I mean, that's something that's currently, in debate right now. I mean, they certainly have story editors who,
they don't have scripts, do they?
I've seen on IMDb people with writing credits.
Well, the host obviously has to have his or her stuff written. And then I think there's a team of kind of like writer stroke editor hybrid type people who kind of decide, you know, what to show and what storylines to focus on and how to try and, you know, what characters to poke with what sticks in order to try and get the responses that will come up with good television. I think that's kind of what they do.
And they haven't figured out a way to make good television yet, but
yeah, I need to, Norm, I want to know how are you going to make your case? Like, why you, Norm?
Statistically, it's got to happen. In every season beforehand,
there you go.
One
sold.
Asian guy. And they've had someone from Berkeley. Not always the same person. But I never thought
I'd find myself actually saying this, Norm, but I don't think you're geeky enough for this.
Oh, no, but I can fake it. All I have to do is provide entertaining television.
I only saw a little bit of the first season, and I don't know if they've changed it since then, but it did seem like, at least in the initial series, they really were going for the most stereotypical kind of Poindexter type guys they could possibly find.
Sure. Hey, Gaz, go to the page, go to the photo page of the current cast. Like,
I don't want to.
There's this guy here.
What's the URL?
It says he's 25. He's not. 14 if he's a day.
Oh.
Hobbies: avid online gamer and comic book collector.
Exactly.
You know what? The good news. The good news is that Norm, if we lose you to Beauty and the Geek, we can hire him.
Norm, do you have to show up to the casting call with a beauty or not?
No, you just. I think you just show up.
So what are you gonna do? Like surely you have to. There's like a talent round or something, isn't there? Like how do you?
No, I think they just interview you and see if you'll make a good TV personality.
What are you gonna wear?
Just normal clothes. I don't think the key is not overdoing it. I think a lot of people probably go into this the auditions like with American Idol and try to stand out by dressing crazy or acting crazy. And
so
I
you don't think you need to be wearing like a I don't know. Like a World
oh, it
War
looks like they kind of mixed it up here. So I guess now they have geeky women and hunky men too.
Just one geeky
just
woman.
One.
That was the big
okay.
conceit for this. Yeah.
Interesting.
What a twist.
Yeah, Norm, are you prepared for that?
Oh, you know, to prepare myself, I want to enter lengthy debates with Dan Stapleton later this afternoon.
Yeah, Norm and I can discuss why Star Trek Voyager was terrible.
Speaking of Star Trek, right. Speaking of,
yeah,
well,
always...
Oh, nice segue.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Well, see, now when you call it out, it's not as great. Actually, before we segue to that, though, I want to actually first ask, is there anything we can do to help Norm? Like, would it be great if we all showed up and we're like, with signs, and we're like, Norm, choose Norm, or do you think that detracts from your geek
record? That will probably detract from it. I can just bring, I'll bring a couple issues to the magazine.
Sorry, too popular.
Have they ever successfully hooked up a beauty and a geek on this show?
They did last
what
season.
Do you mean by successfully?
I'm sure that's.
Are you talking about crossbreeding here, or?
Wait, I thought the idea for the show was that the beauties learn from the geeks and the geeks learn from the beauties. It's
exactly.
not necessarily to hook them up, though.
It's not that's supposed to be to hook them up, but the hooking up would be an added benefit, and that happened last season.
And
I think you
has,
need to describe it as such in your interview. Well, a hookup would be an added benefit.
I think it's time we segued.
So back to the Star Trek segue. So Perpetual, now I don't completely understand what's happened here. Perpetual has been liquidated by Perpetual?
Well, kind of. Perpetual seems to have imploded. Their main investor kind of found out that, hey, we're not going to get our money back. And so old Perpetual has become a new Perpetual LLC or something.
Right.
And
well, there was a new company that was formed by the company that bought them up, called Perpetual LLC. So it's kind of a sub-company. And they are now reorganizing and restructuring. There were apparently no major layoffs, but some of the team that was designing Star Trek Online left when they found out that the new company wants their new corporate overlords want them to turn Star Trek Online into a more casual gaming experience. And what they
now the thing that I think is particularly here's the big question that it's been acquired by a media company quote looking to use Star Trek Online to make its first major inroads into the video game market. This is from GameDaily.com, by the way. Who's the media company?
Well, it's Korea-based Gravity. That they're the ones that kind of helped put this new company together, and of course,
right. So,
and in a lot of Korean games, there's no subscription fee for your MMO, and you just sort of pay as you go. You pay for items. So
it's microtransactions. It is right. The Korean model that like the speculation in this Game Daily article is that they will have microtransactions for items and stuff in the game, which hasn't really caught on in America. I mean, there's no major game that does that, is there?
Not a huge major popular game. I mean, there's plenty of them out there, but nothing like, you know.
But how do you, you know, if you're going to do that, how do you compare with Guild Wars that has no subscription fee and no microtransaction fees?
Their business model was different. They were planning to release the new campaigns or what were they called again? It was campaigns. So they're going to keep releasing those and generate money that way, which I guess isn't going to carry over into Guild Wars 2. Is that right?
Well, that remains to be seen, I guess. Yeah.
I just think it's really ironic that they want to put microtransactions in a Star Trek game, because in the Star Trek universe, there is no money.
There's
money.
Credits.
That's the way of the future. Everyone works.
No, there's Latinum.
Mankind.
But that's outside the Federation, though. Then in the Federation, there's no money. And a Star Trek Online game would almost exclusively...
Well, there's their credits.
Tanner, are you sure you don't want to audition for Beauty and the Geek? I'm just throwing it out there.
you've seen Star Trek 4, and I think it was First Contact as well, where they established there's no money. in the Federation.
Yeah, I never understood how that's supposed to work, but then I guess it's kind of too much to ask them to actually put forward a plausible scenario for a future society that has no monetary economy.
When you have replicators, why do you need money?
And what I don't understand is if they've come up with a utopian society that doesn't need money, how come it hasn't caught on in the rest of the galaxy? Like, apparently, it only works on Earth. The rest of the Federation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Stupid.
Because there's still scarcity in land and space, and scarcity is the base for all economics.
And who cares about Latinum if you could just replicate it?
You can't.
You can't. Well, yeah, that was the idea. Is for some reason.
Oh, Latinum is like something like that can't be replicated.
Yeah.
Yes, is that the deal?
It's something you can't replicate.
You can't wish for more wishes when the genie grants you 3 wishes. Right?
But anyway, we've gone into a tangential nerd spiral from which there is no return.
But you know, in any case, kind of a rough year for Perpetual overall.
Yeah, I mean, the Gods and Heroes was you know, put on indefinite hiatus, aka canned.
Yeah, it's gone. I'm sure.
Has there been any announcement of you know, other than the official, it's on indefinite hold? There's been no. Look, we're just putting it to rest and.
No,
not yet.
Yeah, so it's not going to happen.
Bummer year for Perpetual, but incredibly awesome year for the game industry as a whole, which, as it turns out, has outpaced the growth of the entire U.S. economy by like 4-1. So the gaming industry grew some 17%, whereas the U.S. economy grew a mere 4%. But the thing I think is particularly cool about this is that the video game industry added $3.8 billion to like the bottom line of the gross national product. So we have we have an actual growth effect.
When does that
Take
trickle
that,
down
retail.
To us, Kristen? when is that going to trickle down to my paycheck? That's what
yeah,
I
don't know.
Oh.
Yeah, your dollar is still not worth more than it was.
wait a minute. You're saying right. Trickle-down economics don't work? What? Damn it.
I was watching the Today Show a couple of days ago, and they had Jim Cramer, who's the crazy guy who hosts CNBC's Mad Money, and he actually listed video games as one of his top 5 life-changing investments. So
really?
if you want to start investing in something that might have a good return for you, he suggested video games.
I mean,
you can't just generically invest in video games. You've still got to make a smart investment decision within that field.
Yeah,
you can't
go
to your Schwab guy and say, "Put my money in video games."
In video games.
put it all in Interplay
and lollipops.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really hard to make a decision on that too, because it's not necessarily anything to do with what companies make good games. Because, you know, as we discussed a couple weeks ago, like Interplay made a bunch of great games and they were just mismanaged all to hell and went under, or pretty much under. Atari has a bunch of great licenses and has had nothing but money problems for the last several years.
So what would have been like a really smart investment a year ago? If you could go back in time a year and just put your money in video games, what would you do?
That's Activision is a great one.
Because of
Guitar Hero. Activision is a great one. They just reported, I think yesterday, something like 4 consecutive years or 4 consecutive. Yeah, I think it was 4 consecutive years of growth.
And the highest profits ever.
What about Nintendo? Is Nintendo publicly traded?
They are not
only
in the US.
Japan.
Only in Japan.
Hmm. Yeah. But
well,
yeah, I mean,
yen lying
that would be where you'd want to put the smart money. If you could have got your money in before the Wii, you'd be laughing right now.
Sure. I guess you could try to ferret out the next big hardware.
Can I put my money in a time machine and then go
yeah,
back?
Yeah, you know, Nvidia might not be a bad way to go these days. They're doing really well.
They've always been a good buy.
I feel like we need to put in a little disclaimer here that we are not offering.
This is not financial
advice. Yeah,
this is not insider trading.
Yeah.
Is EA not a good investment right now? I know that the Motley Fool was recommending them for a while.
Well, actually, Jim Cramer lists EA as one of his good picks.
I just have to imagine that they're. I mean, what's their stock price? It can't be cheap to buy EA.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know.
But I mean, I don't know what their lifetime trend is, but doesn't it just progressively just always go up?
Depends about how much they spend on licenses, I think, and how well their licensed games do. I mean, they're pretty reliable because of all their sports games.
I thought they did have a downturn like a year or two ago.
Yeah, they posted some losses, I believe.
Yeah. Hmm.
Why not invest in, or why not invest in something with, you know, like LucasArts, where you're investing sort of across multimedia?
I think they're privately held.
Publicly traded company.
Well, something like LucasArts. I mean, is there anyone else that does sort of cross?
Cross.
Apparently
Sony?
Sony?
Cross.
Sony?
That does cross
Sony
what?
Online?
Or well,
Sony,
I mean, you know, that's sort of working like a cross.
Yeah, let's invest in Sony.
Good plan.
Anyway, I think that's enough financial planning for a while, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, so Jeremy, you mentioned before has nothing to do with financial planning, but you mentioned before that you've been playing a bunch of games, LucasArts games, actually on your iPhone.
Yeah. There's an emulator called ScumVM, which has been out for a long time for the PC, and they've ported it to all kinds of platforms, but most recently the iPhone. So you can now load up all your old Scum games, which include the early Monkey Island games, Day of the Tentacle.
Yay!
Doing it right now.
Yeah,
it's fun.
A lot of people thought this would be the holy grail for the iPhone because those were all point and click adventure games, which is perfect for touchscreens supposedly. But it turns out that it's not ideal. It's kind of ironic because it would really lend itself to a stylus. Because you need that pinpoint accuracy
I've been really impressed by on the iPhone though is when you're web browsing or something, even when you want to press like a really small little link on the screen, even with your big fat finger.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just the programming or whatever it is, but it seems to almost click, you know, the thing that you want.
It is pretty amazing always. That way. You're right. Even if you're not zoomed in, it still does a pretty good job.
Yeah.
But ScumVM is not tailored that way. So it's kind of strange. You can play in landscape mode, which is cool. You can flip your phone and it goes to either portrait or landscape mode, and it gets bigger that way and it's easier. It's a very cool tech, you know, demo just to show your friends old LucasArts games, but I don't know.
A lot of those old LucasArts games, though, were very specific pixel hunts where you had to kind of sweep the mouse over the screen. I don't know how that would translate to the iPhone.
Right. And we should say this is for hacked iPhones, which if you have an iPhone, I'm sure you know all about.
Yeah, this is not an official product in any way, shape, or form.
Plus, even if you get ScumVM, you have to have the original copy of the game. I think
this
only
is the
two...
podcast of disclaimers.
There are only two Scum games that are free for public download.
Which ones?
I forget the names. They're not the popular ones, but they're on all the Scum sites.
Huh. The scummy ones?
Scummy, yeah.
It was so fun. Norm held up his iPhone yesterday and was showing Day of the Danegal. Just
it's cool. It's got music. The graphics look great. It's a real trip back in time, but I don't know if you're going to play the game.
Let's talk about Blacksite Area 51.
Oh, I heard that's really bad.
You know, it's not that it's really, really bad. It's that there are obviously a lot of problems in development, and that's one thing that, you know, kind of tips you off and maybe warns you away from it. One of the developers, I haven't met him, Kristen, you met him, right?
I was actually going to say, yeah, Harvey Smith, who was I can't remember what his actual title is.
He's a designer.
I think he's the lead designer.
Yeah, he's the lead designer. Might be a project head on it too.
Yeah,
he
was the lead designer on Deus Ex. Right. I met him when I was in Austin for GDC, and we had this awesome. I was like starry-eyed when I left. He was just like a really interesting guy, and I was really fascinated by the way they were talking about, you know, their hopes for the game to be this really sort of like subversive political statement, and I thought that was just a really interesting thing. I didn't necessarily think that people were gonna get it, but I thought it was really cool that they were striving to do something kind of different, and they weren't supposedly gonna be so concerned about like how it was gonna play in Peoria, so to speak. However,
well, they definitely weren't. They were definitely very overt with their political message. All of the chapters in the game, you know, it's got like every different little, you know, sub level has a chapter name, and it's all like a Bushism, like Hearts and Minds and regime change and things like that.
And so, each of the guys in your squad represents this sort of very particular, like one is this very like kind of jingoistic, you know, super, you know, America, patriot, and then, you know, the other guy is just like, hey, I just want to get this done and get home to my family. Like, their original vision was that, at least when you're fighting the Iraqis, that you were actually supposed to be, like, sort of stop and be like, hey, you know what? I'm not just shooting an enemy, I'm sort of shooting a real person on the other side. But
well,
I don't know when that comes through.
That the Iraq segment is just kind of like a prelude. There's not a whole lot
before
of time in Iraq. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's kind of a prequel chapter to it where, you know, you're in Iraq like two or three years ago, and then you're in Nevada in present day. So so they do, you know, kind of, you know, hammer you over the head with a lot of that those messages. Like there's one soldier that in your squad that you go up to, and like the first thing he does is, here's a picture of my daughter. they are doing a lot of that with the story. The problems I had with the story were that it was very, very predictable. I knew after that little prelude exactly what the plot twist was going to be and how it was going to end.
Is that just because you play a lot of games?
No, that's because I've, seen a TV show once or twice. And it's very, very predictable exactly what's going to happen. But the real interesting thing here is, there was a Wired blog post, where they interviewed Harvey Smith.
Well, he was actually giving a speech at the Montreal International Game Summit about this.
Were these quotes taken from the speech?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if he's particularly happy with his job then, because the way he's talking here.
He has very little interest in keeping it.
Yeah.
What did he say?
Is this where he said that basically the game development was a nightmare and the game wasn't playable for the longest time, and then they finally got it playable, and then the game basically got released immediately after that?
Yeah.
Went from like alpha to release in 5 minutes.
That's the short version, yes.
Yeah. He said that the game was disastrously off track like a year before release, and then there was not enough time to fix it. The exact quote is, with a year to go, the game was disastrously off rails. And then there were long delays in getting Black Site playable, and once it was, the quote is, it went straight from alpha to final. And, playing it, I can see a lot of that. There were a lot of glitches, graphically and, animation glitches and things that, kind of sour you on a game like that.
It's funny, I just went to Metacritic to see what score it's getting, and this is very Freudian, but in typing the name into the search field, I accidentally typed Black Shite. And then I had to fix it.
Yeah. But I mean, the gameplay itself is not bad. It's just not exceptional. It's very, very average.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. While I appreciate the value of what Harvey Smith has to say about the development process, I'm sure a lot of other people in the development community, found it interesting. Should you really be saying this stuff when they're trying to sell the game? I mean, maybe you should wait to bash the game until like after its window of people, considering whether or not they should go out and buy the game is been and gone.
Right.
Isn't he just hurting his own game?
He's actually being more subversive than the game itself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because, I understand him wanting to say to consumers, hey, look, I know this game has problems, but he also has to think about that, it's not just him that made this game. There's an entire, group of people who made it whose livelihoods may be affected by the sales of the game. So it is very weird that he's going to be going out there and saying this stuff.
And on the one hand, it is nice and very refreshing to hear somebody be very honest about this, because there are often problems in development, and these developers just have to sit back and not say anything about, not tell people that, hey, there might be a problem with this game, because they have to make a living. And, that, I can't imagine that is terribly fun for a lot of these guys who, maybe think that people would be better off spending their money elsewhere, but, don't want to feel like they're ripping people off.
But I do think as Gaz was saying, I think it's useful. It's good insight for, people who aren't in the industry to really understand that, you've got different groups at work. You've got creatives at work. You've got, people writing stories at work, and then you've got the business side at work, and they aren't always able to work well together.
Right. Well, and without the business side, there is no game. So.
No.
So, and you have to accommodate that in a lot of, and
of course you do.
That's where a lot of the difficulty arises. So.
But do you think it worked out well here?
I think that this game, had more problems than a marketing department could fix. So, I think that Chuck is right that it is probably a bad move to come out like within a couple of weeks of the game hitting shelves and saying this kind of thing. I think it would have been wise for him from a business standpoint to not do that, but at the same time, it is nice to hear him be honest.
Yeah, Dan Emmerich over at OXM has mentioned that he wants to do a feature story on why games fail, but it's always been in his head and never materialized because it would be such a hard story to produce because you get so few people actually willing to talk about this, even in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. Poor Harvey, don't you think he now wishes that he'd stayed on the Deus Ex franchise?
if I was Harvey Smith,
well, maybe.
Well, if I was Harvey Smith's boss, though, if I was the guy at Midway, I'd definitely be hauling him over the coals for this. I'm like, dude, if you want to slag off the game, then fine. But, you know, let us, you know, get it out there first. You know, you're not doing anyone any favors here.
You know, that's an interesting idea though, Kristen, because do you suppose it's a coincidence that he's acting like he doesn't want to work at Midway anymore just when they're hiring people to work on Deus Ex 3?
I don't know.
Well, of course, he was project director for Invisible War, and look how that one turned out. I mean, that a lot of people don't really consider that to be in the right up there with the original Deus Ex.
And by a lot of people, you mean everybody, right?
Well, yeah. and that was another example, though, of where business interest really kind of took over the project, because they wanted to make it cross-platform. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. when you take a game like that, at least for the tech at the time, and you try to put it on consoles, you have to have these very constrained levels. And so that was one of the things that they got away from the original Deus Ex, which had huge levels where you had lots of different options for how to play. And then, you know, you went and you took that sort of formula, put it on console, and it just became so much more limited.
Well, I think that's becoming less true, though, where consoles these days are, you know, I mean, the Xbox 360 is pretty much, you know, a mid-range PC.
But back in the days, back when
back in the day.
In my day! But, yeah, that was the problem with Invisible War. Oh, wait, one other thing I wanted to mention on the topic of, you know, console power versus PC power. There was a quote from an article the BBC ran entitled "Pushing the PC Gaming Boundaries," and they got a quote in here from Roy Taylor, Vice President of Content Relations at NVIDIA, saying, "It's absolute nonsense to think that consoles are at the cutting edge. As good as consoles are, they are so far behind the PC gaming experience that there is no comparison. In terms of raw processing power, the high-end PCs are at least three times more powerful." So, and this is a guy who, you know, works closely with the PS3, you know, NVIDIA supplies the graphics for PS3, so.
I don't think this has ever
been... Couldn't you practically hear Dan just, like, twirling his handlebar mustache at the end of that with a flourish?
No, it's a very technical, and you get all kinds of people saying...
That statement is a little misleading. I mean, he equates the PC gaming experience with hardware, which isn't always the case. I think the hardware could be, you know, 3 to 4 times faster, but there's a lot of other things that go into the PC gaming experience that makes it unique. So
right, but he's talking purely about the power, and you hear a lot of people saying, oh, you know, the PS3 has the cell processor and it's really powerful, and you know it is powerful, but you know PCs iterate a lot faster and they get a lot faster much more quickly.
PCs have been helping cure diseases far longer than the PS3 has.
Right.
Hi guys, this is Gordon from East Lansing. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Crysis out there, but it seems like it's all about technology and will my computer run it and the graphics and everything. But I think it deserves a whole lot more discussion about just how fantastic of a game it actually is. I just beat it last week, and I completely agree with Chuck Osborne's review. You know, more than just the graphics and the technology, the sound, the gameplay, the variety, everything about it screams next-generation experience, as cliche as it might sound. It's a must-play for every single gamer out there, even if you have to suffer through it on low settings. I just thought it deserved a little bit more discussion out there. So thanks. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Oh, good old dad.
He is absolutely right. It's a huge shame that you know, Crysis is, you know, gameplay and the experience of it is so overlooked because of, you know, people concerned about whether their PC can play it.
You think that's partly due to EA's marketing?
I mean, it did get a lot of hype that way, and, you know, it is a good selling point on it, that this is, you know, the next, like he says, the next generation, you know, advancement. But it also runs on, you know, not that high-end PCs if you're not Norm and can, you know, bear to turn down the graphics settings until you get a better PC.
It's funny. I'm actually in a position of agreeing with this guy, but actually not liking the game as much. I totally agree that this is like quintessential next generation emergent gameplay. But at the same time, I think I like something that's a little more tailored, a little more handcrafted than the openness of this game, personally.
Well, it's all very handcrafted. I don't know.
Do you mean something a little bit more railed?
Yeah, on rails, right?
Yeah, exactly. A little bit more on rails. Something more like Call of Duty, obviously, which is I've been raving about. But
so, Jeremy, what you're saying is you hate freedom. Why do you hate freedom, Jeremy?
I just felt like it was very redundant. Actually, I mean, it was just very much of the same thing over and over. Squads of bad guys. You're cloaking and then trying to sneak around, stealth, and then take them out. And that just happened over and over again.
So you don't have a problem so much with the idea of immersion gameplay as the implementation here.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, I do appreciate how emergent this gameplay is and that they pretty much just set the pieces in place and then let the AI and, you know, your personal take on strategy take over and create your own experience. So it's probably very different from someone else's. And I really appreciate that. But it didn't grab me personally.
Because of the freedom hating.
Because of the freedom hating.
Now, I can understand, you know, where you're coming from in terms of wanting more variety, and obviously that has to do with like resources and how much time they could develop, you know, how many different environments they could put in the game. You know, a couple years later, if we see something with the variety of Call of Duty 4, for example, and how many different environments that game has, but with the openness of Crisis, I think that would be, you know,
well, here's a question. Jeremy, have you finished Crisis yet?
No, I'm surprised.
How far in are you?
I'm surprised I'm not to the frozen chapters yet. I just got into the tank.
Yeah, that's a much more, well, not still not, you know, purely linear, but actually as you progress, as you get more into the story, they do kind of narrow you into a corridor kind of experience. So maybe you'll like the later levels better.
Okay, I'm gonna
Jeremy,
get it.
If you're the tank, you're only about a third of the way through.
That's what I figured.
Yeah,
it's so apparently a
there's
long,
still
long
a good
game.
Chunk. Yeah.
Yeah, now a lot of people have actually been complaining about that you know, the early levels are really open and then it narrows down into a more linear experience. But I personally didn't have a problem with that just because I like a variety of gameplay, and just having something different doesn't mean it was worse.
Yeah, I think the only time when I wanted more diversity was when I was fighting the aliens. Mm-hmm. Because they're a little bit dumber than the North Koreans and a little bit more samey, but
right, and there are only two types of aliens, really, unless you count the floaty ones, which are only in a short part of the game. So there was a little bit less variety at that point, yeah.
Hey guys, Todd Coco from Louisiana, longtime PC gamer fan, both of the podcast and of the magazine. I think I've got every issue ever produced. Love the podcast, and you guys do a great job. My question is, I'm a 44-year-old gamer who's been gaming since I've been about 13 years old, and don't ever see myself giving that up. Just wanted to know what you guys thought about your longevity in the gaming world. How long do you anticipate playing games? My wife asked me when I'm going to grow up. My response is, game over. That's not going to happen. So game on, guys, and keep up the great work.
They're going to have to pry the joystick from my cold, dead hands.
Wow. Yeah, I can't ever see not gaming. I can't ever.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll give it up. I'll give it up. I'll give it up when I decide I don't like fun anymore.
Actually, you know, this kind of reminds me of a new story, and I know this isn't exactly PC gaming, but I was just reading that one of the new markets for the Wii has actually been that retirement homes have buying them.
Awesome.
You know, because older, the elderly have really been getting into that style of gameplay just because it's so much easier for them to control.
And the different communities and homes are like them because they're encouraging physical activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what, if it helps at all, this is tangentially related, but I think still useful. We've actually had a bunch of, I don't know if you happen to see in our last issue, we did an interview with Hunter Pence, who's a professional baseball player. We've actually had a bunch of, a number of different professional sports people contact us lately from a variety
athletes?
Of sports. Athletes, yes, sports people. Thank you.
I am a sportsman.
And mathletes, too.
In any case, Yes, a number of athletes have contacted us lately to let us know that not only do they enjoy playing various PC games just for fun, but that they feel that playing PC games is actually kind of what keeps them out of trouble. That it, they feel like playing games is giving them an edge over their competition, because when they're in training, their competition is maybe like going out and hitting the bar and, you know, doing stuff out of the house that's not really conducive to staying focused. And these guys stay home every night and play games. So it's keeping you out of trouble.
I can understand where your wife might be coming from in being concerned that you're an old man that plays games.
That you're a man-child?
but it's she shouldn't be. The problem is that there's no precedent for adults playing games because we're the first generation of gamers.
That's not true.
No, well, video games. I mean, we are the first generation.
Of PC games, if you go back and you look at all the hex-based gaming, who was playing that stuff? It certainly wasn't like eight-year-olds. It was guys in their 40s and 50s who were the ones who were able to afford PCs in the first place.
Mainstream gamers. So, but we're the first generation to have grown up with them, and we're probably never going to let go. By the time we're grandparents, every generation is going to be a gamer of one kind or another, I think.
Hey, PC gamer, this is Herman again from Pomona. Hey, you know, one thing you guys never mentioned on your PC gamer podcast is prices of games. I personally have my own little limit, $30 or less. Otherwise, I won't buy it. And so far, I've been able to pick up almost everything, including BioShock, which I just got for $22.50 at Circuit City because they had a $25 special at Best Buy, and they price matched it at Circuit City, so I got the 10% off. And I'll have to just wait a little while for Crysis, but pretty much everything comes around eventually, so that's just my little personal take on it. Another advantage of being a PC gamer. Later.
Well, it just so happens that we're actually going to be doing a story about games that you can get for under $25, some of the old classics and some newer games as well that are playable on XP and Vista, and that's going to be coming up in our February issue. Another resource that I usually go to is DealCatcher.com. They do have listings for Best Buy and Circuit City, and they have they track daily you know, games and other products that are especially cheap. So, you know, just go there.
And I applaud your thriftiness. I think that's great. Certainly, you know, we're if there's games we really want and we want them right away, we'll go out and get them. But I absolutely say, heck yeah, yeah. Be a bargain hunter and don't feel like if you can find newer games for cheaper, go for it.
Especially this time of year when there are so many great games coming out, there's no reason to go out and get them all at once. Just get one, have fun with it, enjoy it, don't rush through it, and you know, get them all when you're ready for them, and the prices will go down in the meantime.
Yeah.
And as we point out before, you know, if you wait 6 months to buy Crysis, you're still going to get a great experience. In fact, you're going to get a better experience than if you buy it right now.
But that's not just true for Crysis. We're at a point now where almost every game holds up. I have a friend that just played Half-Life 2 for the first time, and that's like a 3-year-old game. And it still holds up graphically, and the Gravity Gun is still innovative.
They've done graphical updates to the engine for Half-Life 2 also, so that might not be the best example. But the gameplay, you're right, still holds up.
Well, and Half-Life 2 does not look as good as Half-Life 2 Episode 2. They redid a lot of stuff that didn't carry over. So I mean, it is a decent example. I mean, a lot of the stuff they did was behind the scenes optimizations and things.
But if you were to go back like 6-7 years and then play a 3-year-old game, the difference is vast. We're at a point now where it's starting to be a level playing field, and games hold up better.
They definitely hold up better because they're not. I mean, they were a couple of years ago at a point where the you know, renditions of characters are not embarrassingly bad.
Right.
So, you know, they're still, you know, they still look okay. They're stylized. They look pretty good. So.
Hi, guys. It's Chris from Portland, Oregon. Absolutely love the podcast. Never miss it. I'm an old school gamer, 43 years old, and I still game as hard as I did when I had my very first Apple IIe and then a 286 on up. Gentleman called in last week and was wondering about some old games to possibly download, and one of the guys in the podcast mentioned Deus Ex, the original. And in thinking about my top games of all time, that just may be it as far as strategy, fun, weaponry, gadgetry, an incredibly deep story. I felt that was probably one of my top games of all time, and I'm curious about what your old school top games of all time would be. Thanks a lot, fellas. Keep up the great work on the podcast.
XCOM.
Who saw that coming?
Yeah. Oh, I did. I saw that coming from ways away. going way back, let's see. If I go way, way back, Star Raiders actually really held up for me, even though the AI is so simple. I still kind of like believed in my heart of hearts that the little enemy spaceships were actually thinking and trying to maneuver around. The first Gabriel Knight game is one of my loves. Original Zork, actually a lot of the old text adventures.
I didn't know I could have more than one.
Yeah, you can have more than one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come on, PC gamers, okay. You're gonna go on forever.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Alright, everybody gets one then. Anybody else want one?
I had an old Commodore 64 game called Paradroid, which is one of my all-time favorite games. I think it goes back to, what would it have been, like 86, 87? Oh my god, it was awesome.
What kind of game
is it? It's one of those games where I always wish that it's such a good idea that you can make a really good, kind of 3D first or third person shooter version of it today, but it's kind of lost to the mists of time now. I actually bought from QVC, one of those joysticks. It's like an old Commodore 64 design joystick that plugs right into the TV.
Yeah.
It's got like 50, classic Commodore 64 games on it. And most of them were crap, but I bought it purely because it had Paradroid on it. That's good enough for me to buy the whole joystick.
What about just, you know, from 10 years ago, considering this guy's talking about Deus Ex, which I think was 2000 that came out?
Oh, so I'm too old school for you now?
I
didn't realize I'd get too old school.
Yeah, just trying to, put it in the same zone this guy's talking about.
From 10 years ago? So, let's see.
10 years ago, so...
That would have been like my first year on PC Gamer, actually.
So 10 or 15 years. Yeah.
Duke Nukem 3D. Yeah.
That's 10 years
Grim
ago.
Grim Fandango.
Yeah. Alone in the Dark.
No, that's earlier than that.
If we were going to go way, way back, like the game that always makes my... Jeremy, you and I have talked about this. The game that always makes my heart full is Lode Runner.
Oh, yeah. It's a brilliant little game.
Yeah.
If you go way back, they really do hold up because they're just so...
Right.
Basic. Yeah.
Right.
I would say MechWarrior 2 if we're going for about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Mm. Oh, we're all taking a little walk down memory lane. Oh.
Well, if we're only going back 10 years, then I'm just going to say StarCraft.
Good choice.
That doesn't feel old school to me. Maybe it's getting old.
It doesn't.
Approximately 10 years, I said.
Oh, yeah,
That was 98, yeah.
Wow. It's really been that long.
Yep.
Hi, guys. From the PC Gamer Podcast, this is John. About running Crysis at max settings and not being able to, shouldn't it be the hardware developer's fault that they can't match up with the game? Why should the game have to limit itself to match the hardware at max settings when NVIDIA and ATI should be innovating to be able to have anybody willing to spend the money run everything at max settings? Shouldn't it be the job of the graphics card and the processor innovators? Thanks, guys.
That's a ridiculous argument.
Yeah, it's nobody's fault.
I agree that it's kind of ridiculous, but there's some merit there in that I think if ATI had a competitive card out last year, we would have seen a faster, we would have seen the next generation of NVIDIA cards, which I'm sure they already have ready for production, that they just haven't announced yet, come out this year that might have been, designed already, and they would have, had something newer as opposed to the 8800 GT, which, it's a fast, cheap card, but it's not the next step.
You don't think NVIDIA is being pushed hard enough?
Yeah, well,
I think they have no motivation to.
Well, I think also what he may not realize is that a lot of the developers, they're the first ones to get a look at these new cards, and not the current generation, but the next generation and next generation after that. So they're pretty well aware of what's going to be coming out around the time of a game's release.
Well, they are and they aren't because nobody, even NVIDIA, doesn't know exactly what they're going to have 3 years from now. And when you're starting a game development, it is kind of a shot in the dark.
They don't know exactly, but they have good forecasts.
They have a forecast, but, you know, how often is the weatherman wrong? You know, and we hear all kinds of stuff.
It's not that
inaccurate, but I'm just saying nobody knows exactly what it's going to be like, and sometimes they overshoot, sometimes they undershoot, and the game doesn't look as good as it could when it finally comes to market. So it is a little bit of a guessing game.
But the thing is, like, Carmack used to have intimate relationships with the video card manufacturers and actually had some say.
Really?
I've heard stories.
Yeah. Oh my.
No, he used to have some say in what the next technology would be. And he, you know, because he would be the one making the graphics engine that would exploit it. And maybe the guys at Crytek just didn't have those connections. Who knows?
Well, we can't all be John Carmack and build rockets.
Well, he's not even, you know, what he used to be in the games industry.
I don't really think it was that they were, you know, they didn't have those contacts because, of course, you know, EA was publishing. So somehow I think that they probably did.
Yeah, they were a partner with NVIDIA with the way it's meant to play program.
But, you know, they made a conscious decision that they wanted to plan for the future. And whether you like it or not, that's how they decided to go.
Yeah. Right.
Hello, PC Gamer Podcast. This is Lars from Norway. I just wanted to ask you guys about the new Duke Nukem Forever rumors coming out from Game Guru that Duke Nukem Forever is coming out in 2008 and with a new engine and all for the 100th time. So, I just want your input on that. And, of course, you know, should take that with a grain of salt. But, all right, love the podcast. Bye.
There's been a yearly rumor for the last 11 years about when this game is going to come out. I would discount any rumor that you hear until it appears in our magazine, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, even once they do say something official, I would still take that with a grain of salt because, you know, they've said official things before and it just hasn't come out. So, really, I'll believe it once I've played it.
We had speaking of nostalgia and Duke Nukem, if you watch the videos of Duke Nukem Forever when they first announced it, using the Quake 2 engine, and then when they release a new video using the Unreal Engine, man, that makes you really want to play that game.
Yeah, it looked almost done. It's crazy. We had Scott Miller on Game Theory months ago now. It was a while ago. But he made it very clear that they were maybe 3 years out. So that would put it well past 2008. I wouldn't get your hopes up.
They might, like, announce something by the end of the year. Like, they might show it off, but I wouldn't estimate. I wouldn't, you know. I would not put money on that. That's a bad investment.
All right, what's everybody been playing? Who wants to go first? Chuck, what have you been playing?
Let's see. Well, I've been playing a lot of putting the magazine out, but I actually started playing Hellgate London. I'm not real far into it, but I want to load it up and test it out, and I haven't had any crashes, so that's good.
Were you a Diablo guy?
Yeah. I played all the way through Diablo 2 and the expansion pack. So, I enjoy that style of gaming. Having to configure your own loot, you know, playing loot Tetris, I don't really mind that so much. I mean, I know a lot of people were kind of criticizing the old school design choices in the game, but you know, it works for me. I think the one thing about the game is that it you know, when you kind of put that style of gameplay into first person, you tend to think of it as being a first person shooter, even when it's not. It's still an RPG, and so you kind of have to reconcile those two types of gameplay into one product. Oh, and I was also playing Mario Galaxy, but that'll be my last mention of it.
Magical.
Not talk about that.
Dan, what are you playing?
I've been playing Kanan Lynch and Blackside Area 51 for review. And what have I snuck in a couple little gaming sessions on the side. That sucked up a lot of my time, but I think I played some... I was playing with the Sins of the Solar Empire beta, which I'm enjoying a lot. You can actually get into that if you pre-order the game off of Starduck's site. So it's kind of an open beta to subscribe or to pre-order customers, and it's pretty functional. The AI is kind of dumb right now. They're working on that, but it's a kind of a blast to play if you're into homeworld you know, it doesn't have the full 3D navigation, but it's you know, on a much larger scale. It's like playing Homeworld on a map for Galactic Civilizations. So I'm enjoying that.
I really like that open beta to people who pre-order idea, and I know Valve did it with Team Fortress 2, and it's pretty much a win-win for everyone.
Well, yes and
no, because sometimes you'll play the beta and it's not done, so you might enjoy it and you might you know, feel like you're getting your money's worth, but you're not getting the final experience. And you know,
sure, and
getting,
you know that. I mean, that's the caveat
of
playing the beta.
But you might be sick of it. You might be done with the game by the time it actually comes out. So that's the only cautionary warning for that. And also, you know, sometimes it won't work right away, and you're pissed off. Oh, I just spent money on this, but that's not the product you paid.
You spent money on the pre-order.
Right.
It's an extra
bonus. It's the perception, though.
Sure.
So. Norm, what are you playing?
You know, Jeremy and I fired up UT3 yesterday, and we played a couple matches. So I've been going through that. It sure looks pretty, and it feels like UT. So that's all good, both good things. And also played through Soldier of Fortune Payback, the non-sequel to the Soldier of Fortune series. That review will be
should,
in our next issue.
Should it be called Soldier of Fortune Money Back?
Yeah.
I'm glad UT looks good. I actually just got that yesterday too, and that's what I'm about to start playing.
Yeah, yep. I want to play that.
Yeah. It's on my desk at home waiting to be played.
Norm may not go into it too deeply because he's playing it for a review, but my feeling is that it feels like UT to a fault. There's not very much next generation-y about it besides the graphics and the huge vehicles. But there's just not enough there for me. I'm actually kind of disappointed with how much it feels like UT 2004, which I've been playing recently and still plays great. So I don't know if I need a whole new game.
Is it less? You know, they said that it was going to be less sort of like bouncy, floaty. Is it?
Definitely feels more weighty. The
gravity, yeah.
Infantry, when you're running around, I mean, not when you're on the hoverboard, it definitely feels more weighty.
You can't use a weapon on the hoverboard, can you?
No.
No.
You can't. You can latch on to other vehicles. But when you're in a vehicle, it's really floaty.
It's fun to latch on the vehicles and sort of surf behind them.
The only time I heard Jeremy say the words awesome when we were playing last night was when someone latched onto his vehicle.
Well, that's cool.
No, when I latched onto someone's vehicle and I was skiing behind them.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I haven't played it that much. I just played last night, so I shouldn't say that's how I feel about the game. But it definitely left me feeling a little bit empty.
Your initial impression.
Oh. Yes.
Sorry.
Now, did you really enjoy UT 2004?
I was in a clan. I loved it.
Okay.
And my favorite mode from that is missing from this game. So that's you gotta take
that
into
consideration.
No, Assault was awesome, but I was a bombing run player.
Ah.
One of like four.
You and like 10 other guys.
Yeah. It was very. It was so unpopular. I didn't get it because it was just the most fun I've had in a first person shooter. I loved it. It was this football mode where you could toss the ball and the person with the ball could only run, couldn't use the translocator, couldn't shoot, and your team was protecting that guy to get to the goal. And if you scored, you felt like Michael Jordan. It was awesome.
Gaz, what are you playing?
I've been playing Call of Duty 4. Slowly making my way through it.
How far in the game are you? I mean,
that's Jeremy's
like
game of the year, you know.
I'm not very far. I think what I'm going to do is I think I'm playing through on normal, and I think I'm going to ratchet the
don't say
the
easy, don't say
down
easy
to whatever the easiest one is. What you have to understand is, as I get older, I get slower and I get dumber, and I get less good. I'm not as good at games as I was 5-10 years ago. And I tell you, when I see a review or a comment on a game where someone complains about it being too easy, that's a plus for me. I'll go buy it. Because I don't want games to give me a level of challenge that I find frustrating. I want to just, to some extent, be able to kind of blast through them and see all the content and have fun and move on to the next thing. I'll probably get crucified for this, but that's the way I feel.
I'm with you.
You die now.
I'll play through Call of Duty 4 on easy. I just finished playing through a console game that I'm not allowed to talk about on the PC Gamer podcast. I played through that on the casual setting and had a blast, doing so. I don't feel like I missed out on anything because of it. Hardened veteran and insane. These are for like the young kids, for like, you know, 15, 16-year-old kids that have got fast reactions and can play games at that level.
I'm not asking for hard or veteran. I'm just saying normal, guys. Normal.
No. I'm not as good as normal. I used to be normal, but now I'm easy.
You're making me feel ancient now.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Garrett is a great FPS player. If you go on a multiplayer match at TF2, he's on the top three half the time.
Actually, to be fair, Call of Duty 4 has... I've been playing through it on normal so far, and it's not been giving me too much trouble. But I have heard that the final levels of Call of Duty 4 are a real bitch.
They're not. Don't worry about it. They're not.
By the way, have you gotten to the AC-130 gunship level yet?
No.
All right, I don't want to talk about it then, but we'll talk about it once you do.
Okay. Let me guess. You're in a helicopter on a rail, and I'm shooting stuff with a big gun.
Well, for some people, it's an emotional experience. I'm just going to say.
Okay.
I only got in like the first two missions in Call of Duty, and yeah, it's fun. I don't really see what could possibly be Game of the Year-ish about it.
And you haven't reached a really good part of it.
You didn't like that first mission on the ship?
It was okay.
What?
What was so great about it?
This is why when Dan tells me that Crysis is a Game of the Year, I don't take him seriously.
No, what was great about it? I don't really get it. The ship sank, yes. Yeah, that was kind of neat.
It was exciting.
It was. You were on a sinking ship.
It was like being in an action movie.
You're on a sinking
movie,
ship.
The whole game is like being in an action movie.
There's a sinking ship in Crysis.
Oh, is there?
I know, but and the way you're talking about it, it's like your old ticker can't stand these, crazy.
that scene at the end, that first level when you're trying to get off the ship and the ship is kind of listing and it's going down at an angle and there's stuff exploding and collapsing all around you and the guys are going, go, go, go! That's f***ing great!
I remember doing the same thing in Jedi Knight 2.
Yeah.
There have been lots of games that have done
that.
No, there haven't been lots.
This was the first game since Jedi Knight 2 that maybe even feel
because something similar was done in a game 10 years ago, it's not valid now.
I'm just saying it's not something that makes it stand out in my mind as Game of the Year.
I don't think
there are other moments in the game,
except maybe on formats that don't have.
Dan, are you not going to play the game?
No, I'm going to play it. I mean, I'm just saying, like, I played the first two or three levels, and I'm not blown away by it. It's fun.
If you were,
I've like put it aside to play over the Christmas holiday. Like, I can't wait to play it. It's like a little treat.
You can play.
A matter of taste as well. I'm actually in the Jeremy camp here, and I always like having a strong sense of where I'm supposed to go next. The big sprawling games, I'm like, oh, where am I supposed to go? I actually find that a little bit overwhelming. I kind of like it when level designs. Basically, it's always clear what I'm supposed to be doing next, and Call of Duty 4 is more that kind of game.
Now, for me, I prefer the open free worlds like Crysis, but in a game that's on rails where there is only one way to go, you absolutely need to know exactly where to go, and some games don't even do that, and that's really annoying. But I think Call of Duty does a good job telling you where to go. But there's only one way to go, so it feels a little bit mindless to me to just go exactly where I'm supposed to go. I have no freedom at all, so.
And on that note, we've moved our walkers to the end of yet another PC Gamer podcast. Thank you all very much for listening.
Did you say what you've been playing, Kristen?
What's that? No, actually, I mentioned that I was about to start playing UT. I've just been sort of dabbling in this and that lately. I don't want to say that I've been too busy because somebody on our forums gave me the smackdown for always saying that I'm too busy on our podcasts. So I've been dabbling in bits and bobs. Nothing. I haven't played anything.
The problem is though that we've been shorthanded since Greg left, and Kristen's basically been doing two jobs. So she's not kidding when she says she's been really busy. So
thank you, Dan. Thank you very much.
And we're all too lazy to help her out.
Yeah, and intern Andy has left us. He's gone back home. Yeah. He's gone back to school. So,
So now I have to get my own coffee.
There's nobody left to get our lunch. as I do this right now, I'm peeling scotch tape off of the wall I'm not kidding. I'm peeling scotch tape off the wall where we post up all of our pages as we're doing the magazine because there's no intern left to do it. This is what... Folks, anybody who wants to know what you have to look forward to in the gaming industry, in the gaming journalism industry, this is it right here. You become editor-in-chief, you spend your afternoon pulling scotch tape off the window. Yeah. In any case, thank you all very much for being here. We would love it if you subscribed to the magazine, which you can do by visiting www.pcgamer.com/subscribe. Until then, thanks all very much. See you next week. Well, it doesn't really matter because the main thing we're going to talk about is how Norm is trying out for Beauty and the Geek.
What?
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 That's a great idea.
Is this true?
This is versus. What? True. Let's not talk about it yet. Wait for the podcast. However, I would suggest that you all go to the Beauty and the Geek cast page.
I decline that suggestion.
Oh, no, no, no. I think you're going to want to. Listen, we got to size up the competition, don't we?
Well, this would be in the next round, though, so wouldn't all these people be...
Pretty big week for games, even though they weren't all PC games.
Were any of them
PC
games?
They're not PC games.
That's right. No console talk this week.
Really?
None? No. Damn it.
Halo's going to drop out now.
DJ's going to... DJ will f*** you up.
I just think that there's an excessive amount of non-PC game talk, and if people want that, there are podcasts for that. I mean, we're...
So, you're listening to the PC Gamer Podcast for November 29th, 2000...
Make sure it's November, not December.
Yeah. You know, we got two questions about that.
About what?
People called in pointing out that we got the date wrong.
Awesome. And they posted several times in the morning.
And both callers made time shift jokes about it.
You should play both of those questions, or those calls.
Or not.
Okay, here we go. You're listening to the PC... can't talk today.
The PC Clam Bake.
You're listening to the PC Gamer Podcast for November 29th, 2007. This is episode 110.
But, you know, everybody wants instant messaging, and it's still not there.
Well, Norm and I have it. All you gotta do is hack it.
I don't want to hack it. I don't want to hack it.
Oh, it's just that easy.
Yeah.
It is that easy. If you had if you have, like, the not the most recent firmware, but the one right before it, all you had to do was go to a website, and bam, it was hacked.
Bam!
I don't like hacking my phone.
Oh, okay, though. Don't you run the risk of, like, bricking your phone, though, if you do that?
You do run that risk.
Oh, please. Come on.
Who doesn't have $500 to throw around on another phone?
Who's living on the edge there?
Can we talk about something that interests people that don't have iPhones?
Yes.